Do you ever think you're nothing? Sometimes I think I'm nothing. Useless.
You're not nothing, Muriel. You're amazing. Remember how you were in school? You were so quiet you could hardly talk. You were too shy to look at people. Now you're a success, and someone wants to marry you. You're not nothing, Muriel. You've made it.
Episode 90 of the Cult of Matt and Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to head over to our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. And I'm dropping my book ad. My ebook publisher, Mask Books, is in the early stages of abandonment. And I've been knocked off the release schedule.
They haven't communicated with you at all?
No, I actually wrote my agent and I was like, be nice to know that they were doing something with it. And I don't know what the hell's going on over there. I apologize. I have a plan, I think. I'm going to try to release one of my other novels, self-publish it on Kindle. And so I'm trying to get that together, but it's a slow process.
But we'll keep us updated, will you?
Yeah.
I think they might just be juggling their dates and maybe slowing things up a little bit. Because they had a pretty aggressive release schedule, I thought.
Yeah, but now it's like apathetic, you know, sort of like a procrastinating high school student could probably get my book out faster than whoever's running that publishing house at the moment. So,
well, give us an update either way.
All right. I'd just like to shout out to our listener, Tom Hewitt from Australia. I think maybe he emailed us because we're a little late on this podcast or a couple days late. Unlike us, we're very prompt with our Monday morning releases.
Actually, unlike you, we're very prompt. I'm not a prompt person.
I know. I mean, we've only missed 2 weeks, and that was due to birth and death, life and death issues that Mark and I had going. So We're usually pretty stalwart with regard to our podcast, but not this week.
No, this is the beginning of the end.
Yeah, Mark had some yard work he had to do. It's very important. So a shout out to Tom, and he inquired about my book, and I'm sorry. So this week our movie is Muriel's Wedding, released in 1994. Plot rundown. The unconventional Muriel, played by Toni Collette, is deeply unsatisfied with her life, stuck in the nowhere town of Porpoise Spit, and feeling rejected by her friends and family. Believing herself unattractive and worthless, she seeks meager solace in ABBA songs and fantasies of gorgeous weddings, with herself as the bride. Muriel's life takes a turn for the better, however, when she befriends the carefree Rhonda, played by Rachel Griffiths, who encourages her to take control of her life. Together, the two women travel to Sydney, where a series of liberating experiences help Muriel develop self-esteem and take the first steps towards maturity. This movie was directed by P.J. Hogan, and I'm just going to assume that's Paul Hogan, because he's an Australian.
Yeah, it's Paul Hogan. That's not a movie. This is a movie.
That's
now,
right.
He's done, yeah. He's done a few sort of chick movies. Like, you ever see Confessions of a Shopaholic? Oh, that's a good one. Or My Best Friend's Wedding.
Is that a P.J. Hogan? Oh, no, I'm looking at a picture of him. That is not the Paul Hogan I had. He's not wearing an alligator-skinned cap and leather vest.
You know, I haven't seen any of P.J. Hogan's other films, but there's something about Muriel's Wedding that I really like. I think it's there's a real sour tone to almost the entire film. And I think I really like that melancholy that's so pervasive among the bits of humor.
Yeah, I was watching this trying to figure out why you liked it so much. And I don't know. Her family is dysfunctional. But you don't have a dysfunctional family, so you can't really relate there.
Well, I sort of like the desperation, the sort of impotent desperation of all the people in this movie. Everybody's desperate, but doesn't have the wherewithal to do much about it. I mean, the most successful member of the family is the father, and he has all sorts of legal troubles over the course of this film. He's a real go-getter, but he blames all his shortcomings on his family. I love the sadness in the eyes of Muriel's mother, Betty, and the old suicide plot that goes along with the film as well. It's just, it's so sad. It's so incredibly sad.
It is kind of a sad, I don't know much about, Australian life, but there's a lot of mirrors of it in American life. And that family is, I don't know what it is about. Maybe I think Australia and America are extremely close. I think they're more close than we are to Canada. They have sort of the same mindset and worldview to a certain point. You know, both countries have their share of rednecks. They're both, I don't know, kind of have a racist past, sort of bruise some kind of, first world angst, some kind.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of the self-made man thing going on, that everybody needs to, find their own way and chart their own course, which I guess is sort of true. It's weird that there's so much references to the Dole in this movie.
Right.
I wonder if they still have sort of universal welfare.
Oh, of course. Well, all countries, all Western countries are much more progressive than the United States. That's just kind of a fact. Most of them all have universal health care, and they have some sort of public assistance. And our country is kind of huddled around this predatory capitalist fire that we sort of, I guess, just kind of assume is the way of the world, but really doesn't have to be. So Australia is actually much more progressive than we are with regard to their domestic politics. But I guess my point was, it's just when you don't necessarily aren't that go-getter in a society like that, like ours, you kind of end up as sort of these apathetic, you can like end up in these apathetic sort of eddies where you just can't break out of it. You know, there's everybody. It's just, I don't know what it is. It's a quiet desperation.
I think it's depression, largely.
Yeah. And it's much more rampant in our culture than other places in the world.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that. It's certainly rampant in the Heslop family.
Yeah.
And I think that looking at especially Betty sort of as the source of that sort of sadness. And,
lots of being overweight, lots of smoking in the lounger, watching cricket and TV.
Well, you got to imagine P.J. Hogan is making fun of a lot of these people on the Dole as well in this movie. And there's sort of an acidic feeling I get from the direction, especially with the one of the brothers, I can't remember his name, but who will never mow the lawn, and his hair is always an absolute disaster. It looks like somebody from the movie Idiocracy.
Yeah, that lawn was horrible. I was like, that. I didn't quite get that scene when he's like kicking around the milk carton in the lawn, doing anything but mowing that fucking lawn. Just,
I think he was doing like a childish activity where he was basically kicking the can, pretending he was playing Australian rules football.
And it's one of those things that used to do as a kid where you would be tasked by a parent to go do a chore, and you, out of spite, you wouldn't do it, but you would occupy, like, you know, that part of the yard if you're like raking leaves or something, and fuck off for about five times the amount of time it would take you to just fucking rake the leaves. You just like out of spite. It's like, I'm not going to fucking do this out of spite. You know?
Yeah. And I guess I never quite understood why I hated doing stuff like that. I mean, I was totally like this as an adolescent in my house. There were certain tasks I enjoyed doing, but other ones I didn't. And if I didn't find any pleasure in it, I couldn't make myself do it. There's just no way. I think now I'm able to trick myself into finding pleasure in tasks that I normally would abhor.
Well, I mean, think about, like, why, you know, I was thinking about this weekend, why I was out doing yard work all weekend, you know, doing trimming the bushes, mowing the lawn, putting this side yard walkway in. And I was just like, this would be a 13-year-old's nightmare to be doing this all afternoon. But why am I doing it now? And why? And I think it's like an ownership thing. You can, you know, I own my house and I take ownership sort of in where I live, and nobody else is going to fucking do it. I can't pout about it and then have somebody come and do it for me. But when you're a kid, you just don't have that ownership element, and so you lack the pride necessary to follow through with those horrible house chores.
That's the problem with the welfare state. We don't have an ownership society. Well, you know, in a way, all that rhetoric from the right, they got a point. Well, now, they don't have any answers. Their answers is, see those little tabs on the back of your boots? Pull on those motherfuckers as hard as you can, and you'll make it. Or you'll die from starvation. Well, they don't have any answers. But they're true that if you have no skin in the game, you really aren't. What the fuck is your motivation? I mean, if you were renting your house and you really wanted a path along the side of your house and a nicer hedge, you wouldn't go out there and do it because what's the fuck's the point? It's not my house.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's that. I think expecting people to somehow take pride and ownership in horrible, shitty, nowhere jobs is an insult. I hate that, where people are like, oh, you could go work at McDonald's. I'm like, really? I think the thought would depress you so much that you couldn't even get out of bed in the morning to go apply. So it doesn't take psychology into account. I guess it sounds really nice, but you can't really, you know.
What sounds nice?
Oh, that do nothing should just get up and get a job and get self-motivated. And, you know, it's hard when, like, Muriel doesn't have any really skills to speak of. You don't know. Mm-hmm. I doubt if she went to college, and she's just sort of a...
She went to secretarial schools. It cost $2,000. And you know what? She can't fucking type.
Can't fucking type these days. That's nuts.
Yeah, she's being berated by her father, and she's probably depressed. And she's... You know, she's stuck in this small town, doesn't have any friends. I mean, she's got a terrible existence.
Yeah,
you can't really blame her for being bummed out. She's 22 and going nowhere, still living at home. It's really sad.
Is that why you relate to this movie?
No, I think
You had some spells of...
there was a time I was at home at 22 that I sort of felt this way. Yeah. I mean, what's the point?
I escaped home at 18. I mean, mm-hmm. I boomeranged back a couple of times, but I definitely made the break after high school. The times I did boomerang home were pretty, pretty wretched, but my parents did me a favor and lived in a very small house. And so the proximity was such that there was no room to, I guess, laze about in my lethargy and apathy.
You couldn't hang out in a finished basement and pretend that your parents didn't actually pay the rent.
Exactly. I had to listen to a cacophony of shouts through the house between my mm-hmm. mother and my father through the door, and there was just no way of escaping it. I was like, I got to get out of here.
Those muffled grunts will drive you crazy.
No, they slept in separate beds by that time. So
okay.
No,
well, it's a classic maneuver for the married couple.
Yeah, exactly. This movie was filmed, I guess, in Queensland, Australia, I'm guessing, which is an interesting flip to our Northern Hemisphere geography. You go north to get warm in Australia, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is kind of crazy.
Porpoise Spit, a wonderful little wretched holiday town.
It looked pretty nice, man. It looked kind of like...
It's wretched if you live there. I mean, you see how they hate the tourists. I mean, we've never lived in a tourist town. I mean, I guess...
No.
Not where it's primary thing it does. We both grew up in sort of bedroom communities with maybe some very slight touristy aspects to it. But a full-fledged tourist town, I think you'd probably get pretty sick of that.
I guess. It's funny how all the locals seem to embrace it. They go out to Hibiscus Island, which is just like a little mini tropical island off the coast there.
You have to take a plane to Hibiscus Island. I think
it can't be that far away. It's got to be just like, it seems like everybody kind of goes there locally. It's sort of, our version of Lake Chelan or something.
Maybe, you know, the way they talked about the amount of money that Muriel spent when she stole all that money from her family.
How much did she spend? Like, was it
$15,000? in 93 or whenever this movie came, 95. That's a lot of cash.
That is a lot of cash. I could have gotten through school on that cash, I think.
Yeah. I think that maybe this was a bigger production than maybe than you think, that the whole Hibiscus Island. Because remember, they said they took her to the airport before she left.
That's true, but is it like a little puddle jumper? Like just a little, you know?
It could be. It could be. But
I didn't get
expensive.
The impression it was that far away. Although I just looked up online, and the only Hibiscus Island is in off of Miami Beach.
Well, that was a longer flight than I expected.
Yeah, yeah.
And plus those outfits they wore for the talent show, you know, they look pretty pricey.
Yeah, they somehow like found ABBA costumes all of a sudden in that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool. You ever a big fan of ABBA? Did you ever get into
ABBA? No, but I always enjoy the music when I hear it. I think it's nice pop music. But
I was thinking
not
about
iPod.
What it is with the Swedes and pop music. They got it down to a science, and I don't like a lot of the pop music writers are hail from Sweden, like the people that write Britney Spears albums and things. They have some sort of scientific formula for pop songs, and they've nailed it in Sweden. It's like a national treasure. And ABBA is just sort of the king and queen of pop. You know, what was it like a couple duo or something like that?
It was two men and two women, though I don't really know much about the history of ABBA.
Well, I assume since it's Sweden, they were just like, it was like a big orgy all the time.
Yeah, they were like conjugal cousins or something. Along
exactly. Those. Yeah, because everybody in Sweden is either in an orgy, leaving an orgy, you know, filming a porno, coming from a porn. Sorry, those are my 70s impressions of Sweden.
Great. Now I'm thinking of 70s hairy genitals. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, stumbling through my father's porn collection.
Oh, Jesus. So that first part of the movie, until she steals the thousands of dollars, I think it just reminds me of my sort of aimless childhood of deep, deep depression and feelings of hopelessness.
And then she makes the break. She steals the money.
She moves to the city. She moves down to Sydney
with her friend Rhonda.
Yeah. And the thing about this movie is, you know, the characters of Rhonda and Muriel are played by a couple of really great actresses, Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths. I don't know if you're familiar with both of them. Toni Collette's done quite a bit of TV, and Rachel Griffiths has been on a few programs. She was on 6 Feet Under. I thought she was really good in there, and she's been in other places. I just really like those two actresses. I just really enjoy their performances. I always thought it was interesting that Toni Collette, and all her other performances, this is sort of her breakout performance, she's very thin. And I had read online that she actually put on 40 pounds for this role.
Really?
Which I think is really interesting.
She's not, you know, I was thinking, she's not like, doesn't have an unattractive body. It's just sort of a big boned body in the film. And it's kind of my cup of tea. You know, I kind of go that way more than
parking inspector didn't seem to have any problem with it.
Yeah,
I don't know about those sailors, though.
Emaciated, boyish look that we all find popular today. Yeah, I'm more of a, classic kind of man.
But I think those two performances, I don't know, I just find them really, really interesting. The two characters, that the sort of oddballs that find each other. And I really enjoy the part where, you know, about a third of the way through the movie, she makes it to Sydney and starts working in her video store job.
Yeah.
It's the right step for her. You know, she's got to make her own way, and she's got to get out and, you know, find herself away from that sort of, well, that family's just not doing her any favors. It sort of plays up to her own weaknesses, and she needs to go somewhere where she can have influences outside of the weaknesses that are sort of reinforced with her mother and her sister and her brother.
Yeah. Well, it takes kind of a serious turn. I didn't expect the movie to have so much gravitas there after their night out. And then, was it Rhonda? Basically breaks her back and discovers some horrible cancer. And then it takes an interesting I don't know. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Wes Anderson movies where they're kind of whimsical and silly, but then they have like a really kind of serious point to make in the midst of it. Film style or anything, but just sort of that mixing kind of lightheartedness with sort of serious emotional drama at the same time, which this movie does.
Well, I think it's, in a way, it seems like a more realistic depiction of life in a weird way, because there are moments of funniness amidst all the sort of hardship and darkness that life and sort of, you know, work-a-day things you got to do in everyday life. I don't know, just something feels sort of true about it. And I enjoy the sort of hardship that friendship's placed in and how that Muriel needs to betray Rhonda at some point where she really can't escape her neuroses, even in Sydney. She sort of falls back down that rabbit hole of her infatuations and sort of escapism with this whole marriage idea. I think she's sort of grabbing onto it because she's sort of desperate, and she sort of has developed this fantasy world, obviously.
Right. And so, disregarding,
Rhonda.
Oh, Rhonda. Yeah. And the weird kind of the South African swimmer setup where she responds to an ad basically to keep somebody in the country by marrying them.
I like how they placed that ad right in the fucking paper. I guess, where else are you going to place it back in 94?
I thought 95? Australia has pretty strict immigration regulations, like way more than ours. They're pretty intense.
Well, that's why they had to have the whole fake marriage. It was
no, we do that here. Yeah, but they investigate those things, and you have to interview for green cards and all that good stuff to make sure that you're not setting up the immigration office and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess they don't have any active investigations going on for those sort of things. So yeah, it just ends up in the paper, and she responds to it.
I just love that. I love that when they get to the, I love the coach for David, the South African swimmer. He's so matter of fact about the deception when they first meet at the the indoor swimming pool about what they're doing. Can you, Muriel, lie? Then that whole scene is so great. You got the coach setting up the fake marriage. So this swimmer, he's probably coached for years, can make it into the Olympics. And like the sort of David's like, he's not too sure about this whole policy, and he's certainly not very attracted to Muriel. And then Muriel with stars in her eyes, seeing that, you know, the sculpted body of David and sort of the idea of getting married, which is sort of fulfilling her fantasy life. I just love those three together in that scene where everybody's on such a different page. It cracks me up.
It kind of speaks to that whole wedding psychology in women. And it's weird. I guess I don't really understand it. We had a pretty tame wedding. I wouldn't call it tame. You were there. I mean, it was, mm-hmm. It wasn't like facade. Like, it wasn't expensive is what I really mean.
We're talking about the, Holiday Inn conference room and some little smokies.
That's right. Yeah. Some little smokies. I was dressed in a Sears.
I brought some Hot Pockets and Bud Light.
Yeah,
Natty
exactly.
Light.
Toned down. But the cost for weddings is extraordinary. And it seems like it preys upon what's going on in Muriel's wedding, where if you really – if you don't ever want to, you know, undercut your whole experience, so you got to pay top notch for – you know, a DJ, like $2,000 for a DJ. That's like going rate for a DJ, $2,000 to $3,000 to get a DJ to show up.
Yeah. But man, you gotta mix those tunes. That takes years. That's like a PhD master's level type study.
I can't think of any other occupation where you get paid $2,000 to $3,000 in less than 4 to 5 hours, unless you're a Wall Street goon. Or, you know, somebody to that effect. That just seems extraordinary.
But you get the DJ, you get all the amps, you get the speaker, you get the great selection of shitty 70s music.
Oh, yeah, and that's the other thing. I'm always very most of the time they're pre-programmed by the bride and groom. You know, it's like, oh, we got to have this, we got to have that. Mm-hmm. They got to do a little announcing for toasts and things like that and segues from one bit of the ceremony to the next. I just don't understand that. I think that's pure it's totally fleecing the bride and groom, the whole DJ thing. And there's all kinds of shit like that with regard to weddings. I don't even know how much the average wedding costs anymore. I want to say like 30, 40 grand, which is extraordinary.
If it does, I won't be getting married anytime soon.
Yeah. So, but she's totally enraptured by that
the
whole
idea
thing.
You really see she sort of falls back into her fantasy life. She goes so far as to say when she was living at Porpoise Spit that she would just listen to music in her bedroom all the time. And if you're still doing that at 22, I think you probably got a depression problem.
Yeah. The delusion component of the depression, that's how I guess I know I'm never really that depressed. I would never delude myself to the point of thinking that that sort of situation would be authentic and I would be into it. Like, it would always be empty calories, fabricating an experience like that. And she doesn't get to that point until well on in the ruse. It's interesting. I guess that's what I didn't quite understand about
the character. I think it goes to say the authenticity of her mental illness. It's really
disturbing. You think she was authentically mentally ill?
Absolutely. Yeah. She has
delusional. Was she like bipolar, do you think, maybe? A little bipolar?
No, I don't think so. I think she had developed a coping mechanism for her despondency by sort of falling into a fantasy world. I think that's why she was able to, I mean, just imagine stealing 15 grand from your parents so you can go have a blast.
Oh, dude, who hasn't? Really? I mean, come on. Getting
well,
into the jewelry.
It's sort of
a
dark
a
side
times.
Of this character, how dark Muriel really is. I mean, she's a weird, terrible mix of her father and her mother, of Bill and Betty. She's got all of Betty's depression and lack of motivation, and she got all of Bill's lack of scruples when it comes to, you know, behaving in a moral fashion.
Is she an authentic klepto? That was the other thing. Her mom is, but is she an authentic? Because she
that is so sad when Betty steals those shoes. Because you know she's hard up for money, and she's sort of a space cadet already. So you wonder how, you know, what percentage of her conscious mind was aware of what was happening.
It's like the shoes are like $5.99 on the
discount bin. Plus she was buying a bunch of other stuff, right? She had she had like the bill was like 70 something, whatever they got down there. I don't know.
She does that.
Aboriginal scalps, whatever they pay.
She does that thing that Canadian shoppers do at Bellis Fair to escape taxes. They go down to Bellis Fair and those outlet malls, and then they buy like new clothes, and then they wear those new clothes home. And then trash the old clothes. And so they used to leave them in parking lots. And
so they'd wear down some shitty old shit?
Yeah, like, wear your shittiest clothes. We're going to the U.S. today. And then they would come down, and then they would basically strip in, I don't know, a changing room after they bought the clothes or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can wear your stuff out.
Yeah, and then they would dump the clothes in the parking lot. So, like, at the end of a Saturday at the Bellis Fair Mall in Bellingham, there would just be strewn, like, you know, like a Goodwill truck exploded all over the place. And so then they got wise, and then they actually started putting Goodwill, you know, clothing bins all around the parking lot because they knew Canadians were doing this to escape tax. So she does the same thing as if she's lifting it. She just wears the shit out, which you could probably get away with more than you think.
Yeah, especially an older woman. Boy, it sure was sad. I mean, her life was really had gone to the shitter by that point, Betty's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, Muriel's willing to steal that dress to wear to the wedding of her so-called friends at the first scene of the movie. Sort of a really tight leopard print, number.
And then she gets arrested for stealing it, which is...
Yeah. They have that whole character of the loss prevention person that's really tracking down people pilfering $5 shoes.
Gumshoe detectives there in Porpoise Spit.
But that's just another of the sad, sad moments in this movie. They just tickle me.
Well, yeah, and then her friends are awesome. The I guess the glamorous nowhere crowd. We probably have them back in our old hometown of Snohomish. You know,
I'm sure.
They reach the upper echelons of the hometown and know that if they go anywhere else, that status will evaporate quickly. So they're
the big fish in a small pond syndrome.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people are like really into the big fish in a small pond. It suits them. And most of the time they're people who are popular in high school and didn't have the motivation or educational drive to get out of it. And that's why I don't go to my high school reunions.
I could consider myself a fish in a go fuck yourself pond.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a fish in a fucking contaminated, toxic pond of
full of bicyclists that don't obey.
Yeah, I don't have a metaphor there. Forget it. But yeah, I liked how now I forget her name. The lead cheerleader of the bunch starts talking about her and her recent husband's infidelities already.
Well, she finds lipstick on his cock.
Yeah.
See, the thing is, on their wedding night, she found lipstick on his cock, but he had also fucked one of her friends. So did she get his dick sucked by somebody else after?
No, I think that was the same girl. I think that was her. I think.
But
she
wouldn't the act of sexual intercourse wipe the lipstick off? I don't know. I'm gonna have to.
No,
look
I think
this.
I think that's all she did, or did she go? Oh no, that's right. Because he was the.
This was another
dude.
Person. The lipstick on the penis was from a fourth party.
Right.
That guy was pretty sexy with his long blonde hair.
I know.
Her husband.
I'd do him. Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, he had that beach glow. It's something that you can only get if you hang out on beaches.
Look,
for at least four
I understand, you know, you've been married for 5 years, 10 years, and maybe it is all cracked up to be in the old bedroom, and, you know, you meet somebody at work or something and you have a fling. I get it. But who the hell fucks one of the bridesmaids on their wedding day?
Yeah, I know. That's crazy. It happens.
I mean, that's just nuts.
It happens, I'm sure.
I mean, what are you doing getting married?
Yeah.
I mean, if you really want to go be a player, wait a couple of years and sow your seed around a little bit more. I don't get it. But I guess it does happen, which is sort of amazing.
It is amazing. Well, human nature never fails to disappoint me.
He did have some primo genes, though, so I can't knock him too hard for trying to spread the old baby batter around.
I can't relate. I will never be able to relate. I can't get in that headspace. never tempted like that. So
that would be a weird world if you're constantly tempted like that. God,
wouldn't that be weird, man?
I'd get into so much trouble.
Could you imagine, like, you just make eye contact with the chick, and you just get the look, and you know it's on?
Yeah, there's people like that. I knew a friend of a friend who was like that. It was just amazing. He had this magnetism that women would just come to him. It was the strange. And yeah, I didn't think he was that good. I mean, he had a nice body. But I didn't. There was some sort of aura that he exuded that just women found irresistible. It was the weirdest thing. I don't know where he learned it. I don't know if it was an innate ability that he didn't understand. I have no idea how it worked.
Of course, they're all dialed into it too. So it's just like picking it up off the street. You just like I could go out in the street and grab it, or I could just keep on walking. And
yeah, there's
it's
a great nonchalance
choice.
About it that comes with that.
There's no work. It's not really that much work, you know.
You wonder if these people have put in the hours beforehand, you know, in their adolescence. They really worked hard on developing this sort of persona that was very attractive and went through all the work of figuring it out. Now it's sort of effortless. Well,
to put in the work, you got to scrimmage, which means you have to have the opportunity to scrimmage. And if you don't have any opportunity, you don't get the practice in.
The terrible catch-22, Matthew.
It is. It's horrible. I can't relate. I have no pity, though. I have no pity for those people.
So I guess in this movie, Muriel finally sort of comes to realize how much of a piece of shit she sort of turned into, I guess, after her mom kills herself. And sometimes that's what it takes. It takes your own mother to suicide for you to finally see the light. And I think she finally realizes that she's sort of the, as I said earlier, a bad mix of the worst of her mother and her father. And she says as much to her father that, you know, she's got to stop being a bastard about everything.
That revelation moment where she comes to, I guess, terms with her mania, depressive mania, if you will.
Her bad coping behaviors, I like to call them.
Yeah, and I guess the people that she's hurt in the process, which basically just seems to be Rhonda and maybe her mother.
Yeah, she hurt Rhonda quite a bit. I mean, it was a tough situation, but yeah, and she certainly hurt her mother. I mean, it's just a sad ending to a sad story with Betty.
Yeah, you know, in sort of the, I guess, apologist culture of our current time, though, it seems that the blame isn't, I mean, she takes blame in the movie, but I think like modern pop psychology would allow her to, I guess, dismiss all her shortcomings and blame it on other things, like her, how she was raised and her family and all that. But here it's a little different.
I mean, it is a little convenient how she's finally sort of woken up to the problem. Almost, it's too convenient. I don't really see it being set up properly. I mean, why would the suicide of her mother really shake her out of it? I mean, she's so deep down the rabbit hole. And for fuck's sake, why does David start to be attracted to Muriel?
Yeah, that's weird.
Especially when she's going to abandon the marriage and basically throw everything they did down the toilet. Unless they'd been married long enough, the passage of time isn't exactly communicated clearly in this film.
No. Maybe I wasn't following it as closely, but the, like, her transgressions, were they really that horrible? I mean, okay, she stole from her parents and she kind of treated Rhonda like shit, but
she stole
helped,
from
like,
a department store.
Yeah, but was it really that horrible? I don't know. I mean, that's why I'm talking about the apologist culture. I have a, you know, it's hard to really.
Stealing $15,000 from another party that bad? How would you feel if somebody stole $15,000 from you?
Well, I mean, they're kind of shitty parents, especially your dad.
It was bribe money.
Yeah, he had it coming, really. Yeah. You know, it's.
Yeah, but don't we all have it coming?
Not like that. I mean, that guy really had it coming. He really deserved to have one of his daughters steal $15,000 from him, in my opinion. He's a total shithead to him. And he was also a horrible racist. He was there at that, I guess, business meeting with his family and those Japanese investors. And
oh, yeah.
Figure out if they were Chinese or Japanese. But his faults were never his own. They were circumstance. And it's what he always, like, went on about, you know, that his family was holding him back from opportunity and all this kind of crap. So he's kind of a shitty person.
Yeah, but his family wasn't really helping. Sure, maybe he sowed that field, but still, those were the shitty stalks of corn were his children.
Yeah, but still. So when she ripped him off, I was like, well, kind of had that coming. So I didn't.
Yeah,
I didn't
you can't feel so
be...
bad for him, but how about for Betty? I mean, she sort of bore a terrible guilt and ended up destroying the marriage and finally the breaking point. Maybe she was a lost soul already, so maybe we should just write her off.
I don't know. It's sort of like a domestic survival situation, you know, everybody for themselves. So I didn't really blame Muriel for kind of abandoning that whole thing and even her mom. So, you know, there's that. And then when Rhonda has her accident, she's not like, Muriel abandons her. She totally helps her and takes care of her, and even to Rhonda's dismay at one point. So I don't really see. And then she gets kind of taken up with this whole wedding thing. But is that really a trespass? I didn't really see that as a big deal.
No, I mean, she was trying to get what she wanted. I mean, I don't think it was particularly healthy for Muriel to do this whole fake wedding business.
But it didn't really hurt Rhonda, did it? Why was it hurting Rhonda?
I mean, there's a. I mean, when you have an illness, you become terribly dependent on people, and unfortunately, it's a price you ask of others. And I mean, Rhonda had to ask somebody.
Yeah.
And Muriel was maybe the one she asked. If anything, Muriel owed the debt to Rhonda to sort of shake her out of her doldrums a little bit and give her the courage to go out on her own.
I don't know. So
not that she owe something to Rhonda. I mean, sometimes I think life serves you up with something you have to do. And I think helping Rhonda for a while to come to terms with her disability is maybe just something that would have been morally right for her to do in this situation. As unpleasant and an inconvenience as it seems like it would be, sometimes you shouldn't just cut and burn, especially when it's a good person like Rhonda.
So I didn't really see Muriel as like, she's not like a drug addict stealing from, you know, those closest to her for drugs or anything. It was just sort of I didn't really see her hurting that many people. I mean, she's sort of a victim of
circumstance. I don't have a problem with her actions necessarily. I find her interesting, unhealthy coping behaviors the most interesting aspect of the character and her stratagems to deal with depression and finally finding herself in this movie with some sort of funny scenes and jokes, like the great scene where the parking inspector is trying to get her leather clubs outfit off.
That just cracks me up, man.
Those balls go all over the place. And they're still all over the apartment later when you see Muriel putting photos in her Our Wedding photo albums. You can see the little balls of styrofoam still on, in the deep blue shag carpeting. It just cracks me up.
Her leather pants were sort of like leather mom jeans. They're pretty hilarious. They had like that big, kind of fanny push out, you know, because they're hiked up a little too high.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny nightwear.
Yeah, you know, there's something about leather club gear. Probably want to not be 40 pounds overweight if you're going to squeeze yourself into those.
I never want to wear leather pants. I hear they're the worst. I just don't know why people sell those and people wear them.
So why don't we go ahead and check out reviews on this film. Ebert reviewed Muriel's Wedding on March 17th, 1995, gave it 3.5 stars, which I have to say is a pretty damn good review by Ebert, since it's out of 4. He says, Muriel's Wedding is another of those Australian films that walk the careful line between satire and misery. I think it walks that line pretty well. He says it is a merciless portrait of provincial society, yet has a huge affection for its misfit survivors. I guess that's one thing I like about it. I mean, there's all these fucked up people, but the film seems to respect them in a way. It doesn't make too much fun of them, which I really like. It's not, what would be a similar movie that makes fun of its characters? Napoleon Dynamite.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah, it's got a bunch of misfits, but it just laughs at them the whole way through. See, it doesn't have the heart this has. It has some similar fucked characters, but with no heart. It sort of has, there's something about, Napoleon Dynamite's a fun watch, but it doesn't really hit you in the gut at all.
Have you watched Napoleon Dynamite?
Yeah, a couple times.
Oh, I thought you said you didn't watch it.
No, I've seen it. It's a fun movie, but I liked it more right after I viewed it the first time, and I've liked it less as time has gone on. Just because it doesn't have a heart.
Oh, I love Napoleon Dynamite. How dare you not like Napoleon Dynamite as much as me?
You see here. I like how Ebert describes some of the characters in his review, which is basically the entirety of the review. He says Muriel is big boned, a term that you used.
Hold on a second. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. She actually showed up in The Sixth Sense as the mom, and I thought she was pretty hot. I didn't think she was like, she didn't seem like big boned in that. I thought she was pretty hot. No,
as I said, Toni Collette put on a bunch of weight for this. Big boned's a nice way of saying fat.
Yeah, but it's not really the same. I always think like big boned is not really. I don't know. I consider there a descriptive difference between big boned and fat.
When you say big bone, that means you'd like to give them a big bone. Is that what you're saying?
Sure.
He describes Tony Collette's character as, when she is wounded, she retreats to her bedroom, drowning out reality in ABBA songs. I think that's pretty much what she does. She calls her friends swimsuit issue wannabes with promiscuous but grim sex lives.
Grim sex lives.
I like that. Swimsuit issue wannabes. That's a grim sex life. I'm going to have to start using that term. I'm not sure where. He says that Betty, the mother, is a thoroughly cowed woman. That pretty much describes her really well.
Pretty good.
Right. Let's see what else they say. And she talks about the other characters are couch potatoes who sit stunned staring at the television. That's, if anything, those are the characters it makes the most fun of, like the brother.
Yeah, the brother's great.
And the funny thing about this we didn't mention is that Muriel, this is what Ebert says, has had enough ambition to flunk out of secretarial school. If anything, she's the most driven of all these terribly undriven people.
To flunk out, to at least try something and then flunk out of it.
Yeah, she at least has the guts to fail instead of never try.
Yeah. Although, do you really fail at secretarial school, or do you just drop out due to lack of ambition? I don't think anybody has ever gave secretarial school a go.
Well, she didn't fail out of secretarial school. She got the diploma. She just couldn't actually do secretarial work afterwards.
Okay. She's
factually wrong here.
She got like a University of Phoenix degree, which
she got like an associate's of secretarial work. Yeah, she couldn't type.
Which like an online university, which gives you a degree but is worth nothing. So
yeah, it's like University of Phoenix. Those fuckers. Oh, and this podcast, by the way, is brought to you by University of Phoenix. Find your own internal Phoenix. Let's see here. He talks about Rhonda, that Rhonda really sparks life back into Muriel. I think that's why she's such an important character in Muriel's life. And that's why it's so sad when she abandons her, because I think she really owes Rhonda quite a bit. See what else she calls, David, the swimmer, an empty eyed, swimming star, which I like that look.
Sure.
And he says that, the movie has a lot of big and little laughs in it, but also has a melancholy undercurrent. And I wouldn't really call it an undercurrent. It's the main current of the film.
It's an overcurrent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the comedy just barely keeps from drowning in it, which I think is part of the fun about this movie, is that it's just, you just can't imagine a laugh would come up in all the sadness. And that pretty much sums up Ebert's review. So I think he really liked it, and I like this movie quite a bit too, mainly because of my feelings for the characters.
I can see now, Mark, your affinity towards this film. Your quiet desperation there of domestic entrapment, post high school, lack of ambition. I'd say a mild victim of circumstance, but
I have a bonus review from Robert Roten from the Laramie Movie Scope.
Get the fuck out. You found
Robert Roten reviewed this movie in May 8th of 1995.
Why is he not in the top critics? Why do I have to go to all critics to find Robert?
I'm sorry. Roten? He sums it up as this. The somewhat homely Toni Collette, whole purpose in life is to get married. How she does that and what happens after they are a couple are the many delights and surprises of this film. And that's his sum up.
Oh, well, he's into brevity.
It's a very short review.
Yeah.
But whenever I can find him, Roten's reviews, he still writes, by the way, I'm going to throw it in as a
bonus. Is he writing out of a basement in Laramie, Wyoming?
He still lives in Laramie. Yeah.
Get the fuck out, man. That guy is a soldier. I couldn't do it. I had to escape.
I think I was reading his life history. I think he grew up in Portland.
Really?
And how he ended up in Laramie, I'll never know. I bet he's like an academic who went there to work at the school, maybe.
Yeah, I wonder if
he's like an English professor or something.
Let's see. After graduating from the University of Oregon with a journalism degree, I wrote for several newspapers in Oregon, Michigan, and Wyoming, writing news stories, columns, editorials, and movie reviews. Started my movie review webpage in 1996. I retired from newspapers in 2000. but continue to write reviews online. I was elected president of the Laramie Film Society in 2000 and continues to, wow, he is a stalwart of the Laramie, Wyoming community there in Albany County. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, and just imagine all the privileges that come along with being the president.
Dude, when you're royalty in Laramie, Wyoming, I tell you, you know, you can get into any bar you want there at any time.
There's, it's nothing but open Budweisers and golden cowboy boots.
More or less. Laramie has, I think, 26, 27 bars, at least it did 15 years ago when I was there.
Wow.
Which is roughly
one bar, person having it.
per 1,000 people, which it seems like a fairly high ratio. But
that includes children.
Yeah, that's true. And the elderly.
And the elderly who can't drink. I only have a feeding tube.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, but next week we're going to be entertaining a little bit more Halloween fare. Movie that we need to do is Romero's, not Dawn of the Dead, which was recommended, but I would like to do Night of the Living Dead because I think it's seminal, and without it we wouldn't have our cornucopia of zombie entertainment today. And Mark can maybe chime in on his philosophy of zombies, and then maybe I will muse upon why we find zombies so fascinating. And I think I'm with you. I think I'm
forgetting. I think, what is my philosophy of zombies? I guess I'm going to have to remember by next week.
Mark thinks it's an excusable outlet for our homicidal urges.
Like, oh, that's right. That's right.
We can really get – we can cheer and champion wanton homicide through zombie films, and it provides a release. It's also funny. I don't know when you see, like, you know, a zombie get their head taken off. I don't know why that's – why is that funny? I can't – it just is, you know.
I guess it's funny.
There is a great bit in The Simpsons ages ago when The Simpsons used to be funny and relevant, but it was one of their Halloween episodes, and it was some zombie apocalypse, and Homer – shoots Ned Flanders, you know, stumbling through the hedge, and Bart goes up to him and is like, "Dad, you shot the zombie Flanders." And he's like, "He was a zombie." All right, until next week.
What a bunch of cocksuckers.